This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we talk with Naomi Klein on the boycott, divest, and sanction movement against Israel.
Looking for an idea whose time has come? Listen and hear Naomi Klein tell you why.
We'll also talk with Adam Shapiro.
Adam is one of the founders of the International Solidarity Movement, active in the occupied territories, and active on stopping the slaughter going on in Gaza. Stay with us.
Michael, we hear that Obama plans to close Guantanamo. What other updates are happening now? And we know that will take a while.
You know, he says that he's going to close it. He said that he or others in his transition team said that the day after he takes office, the 21st, he's going to issue an executive order closing Guantanamo. But then he also said that may take a while. It may take up to a year. And so really, the devil is in the details, as they say, because how is he going to close it? The center is put forth a very strong position. There's 250 people left at Guantanamo. We think it can be closed, or at least determined to be closed, in 3 months. We believe you can either charge and try people, of which there's a handful, or you release them to their home countries or other countries where they can get asylum. That's our position. We think it can be done. Sadly, there's another position, and we're not sure which one Obama's going to come down on, which calls for preventive detention, which says, well, there's some people we can't try either because they've been tortured or they're too dangerous and we don't have the evidence or we can't send them back or whatever. And we need to keep those people in a preventive detention, which means hold them without trying or charging them. That would be just, in my view, a repackaging of Guantanamo, which would be really an outrage. And you've seen leading up to the inauguration a couple of attempts by the Bush administration and others to try and push that line. The two that have come out most recently are, one, they have claimed that 61 of the Guantanamo people who've been released, there's been about 500 released, have, quote, returned to the battlefield. Now, a few months ago, they claimed that 37 had, quote, returned to the battlefield, or some number like that. We examined the ones that we had the names for, and the entire operation is BS and a propaganda operation. What we found is they consider, for example, of return to the battlefield, five Uyghurs who were found to be not enemy combatants, who've been given asylum in Albania, and they said they returned to the battlefield because they gave interviews with the New York Times about their situation. They were listed as return to the battlefield.
That's beautiful.
But the point of return to the battlefield is really that these people are too dangerous to release, and therefore we have to set up a preventive detention scheme.
And too dangerous in that they might speak about what happened to them in Guantanamo?
Now, to the extent there's any legitimacy to that, which I think there's little or none, really, you know, there have been scores of people returned to Saudi Arabia. And Saudi Arabia actually has a rehabilitation center that people go through that the U.S. has lauded as really working. So to the extent there's people that you have any doubts about, there are ways of actually dealing with it in a combination of rehabilitation centers and some kind of surveillance. So I think it's just a made-up push by the Bush administration to try and say, see, Obama, this is going to be much, much harder. The other incident that came up just really today was the admission by Susan Crawford, who was the convening authority for the military commissions at Guantanamo, saying that our client at the center, Mohammed al-Qahtani, had been tortured. He's, of course, one of the most notorious cases. He's the one we have the Time magazine log on. He has the 50 days of stripping, hooding, sleep deprivation, dogs, intravenous feeding, sexual humiliation, the whole bit. He's the one that Philippe Sands wrote the book about. And so she said, Susan Crawford said, she thinks that what happened to him constitutes torture. So the question is, why did she say that all of a sudden? And we're discussing that right now among us. One reason may, of course, feed into the preventive detention scheme. Now that he's been tortured, how do you try a guy whose testimony is the result of torture? Well, the answer is that if there's independent evidence, you try him in independent evidence. If there's not, just like anybody else, you can't try him. He's a Saudi Arabian, and he can go through the rehabilitation scheme, if that's necessary, in Saudi Arabia. That's one reason Susan Crawford may have said he was tortured today. A second one, maybe they're looking for preemptive pardons, that they're actually saying, see, there was torture here, more than just waterboarding, there was torture. And Bush better pardon a whole crowd of people who did this. We don't know.
Michael, the only question that Bush wouldn't answer on his exit interview was the question about pardons. What do you think about that?
It was interesting that he just refused to answer it. I would still say there's a fair chance he's going to pardon the torture team, which would include, in generic, not by individual name, but by what the type of conduct in the statutes violated. And he's going to say that anybody who allegedly violated the war crime statute or the anti-torture statute is hereby pardoned. I think there's a good chance that that's going to happen. There's too much in the air right now. Obama has said, and I must say, very little makes me angrier than when I hear Obama say, we shouldn't necessarily be looking backward, we should be looking forward. Yeah. I find that to be...
Oh. Although he did say unless criminal activity arises.
That's true. Yeah. I'm reacting to it because if there's anything that criminal prosecution does, is that it looks forward. That's one of the reasons we do it, to deter people from criminal conduct in the future. And how are you going to deter a Vice President Cheney who says he was one of the architects of waterboarding, who says, I would do it again. How do you stop that except by criminal prosecution and sending that message? So I would wish Obama would stop this forward-backward language and just say, going forward to stop torture, we have to investigate and prosecute the torture team. That's what I'd like to hear.
Michael, I'll take you out for a steak dinner if that comes across.
Yeah, the only prosecution that took place of vice presidents or presidents was Spiro Agnew. He was prosecuted not for what he did when he was in office. He was prosecuted because he was taking bribes when he was governor of Maryland, and then he got prosecuted. Yeah. Well, that's quite different. These guys would be the first prosecuted for really actions they took in the name of supposedly the United States for torture.
Well, the CIA is lobbying heavily for pardons and for no prosecutions.
So we're involved in this really big debate about how Guantanamo is going to be closed, what Obama is really going to do. Until we see that executive order, we don't know. I do know, unfortunately, there's a number of people out there, liberals and others, who are buying into the idea that we might need a preventive detention scheme. I find it really a nasty piece of business, actually. We have some expectations of hope going into the new administration because at least there'll be an executive order saying close Guantanamo. I have less expectations of hope on prosecutions of the high-level officials in the torture program, although it's hard to understand how people aren't just fighting for prosecution right now after Cheney admits waterboarding and said he'd do it again. I mean, it's just like it's really gross to see even people who know better saying, oh, let's set up a truth commission. What do we need that for?
Heidi, there's an interesting issue that's coming through the courts now in the First Amendment.
It involves something called crush videos. I'd never heard of them. The idea is reprehensible. It's when women use either their bare feet or high-heeled shoes to inflict damage on small live animals, such as puppies. And apparently, this is done in a certain fetish community. And in 1999, a law was passed, signed by Bill Clinton, making the showing of videotapes of such practices unlawful. And in fact, Bush issued a signing statement at that time saying that the law would only cover instances in which these films were used for prurient interest. In fact, under the Bush administration, the law has been used in at least three prosecutions against dogfighting videos. Recently, this past year, the Third Circuit reversed this case.
What had happened?
Well, Clinton signed a law saying that the showing of these videotapes is unlawful, so that the act itself wasn't made to be unlawful. But if you showed a videotape of it, you could be prosecuted. In fact, the only cases that have been brought forward since the law was signed have been pit bull fighting cases. So a video shown of a pit bull, the people who showed it have been prosecuted. What's happened now is the Third Circuit actually recently ruled that the law was unconstitutional. To prosecute an individual who showed the video.
Just shows it, not who actually does it.
Exactly. Right? This would be carving out another exception in addition to obscenity, child pornography, to the First Amendment.
So the Third Circuit said you
cannot outlaw the showing of the videotapes. It's protected First Amendment activity.
I have a side question on this. I thought I read this somewhere else. What if we just did it as a fake video of showing someone that it looks like they're stepping on a dog or looks like dogs are fighting, but they're not really, and we tape that and show that. Is that outlawed also?
I don't think that is outlawed.
If it's fake?
If it's fake. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think the defense would be we just enacted this. But the problem is, it's such an appalling practice that a lot of people respond and say, of course, this should be outlawed, the showing of the videotapes. And in fact, I think we'd all agree the practice should be outlawed, but the videos should stand as reprehensible as they are.
Yeah. Well, the problem with liberals is that they always think they can solve a problem by making the government pass a law. The underlying practice, that's no good. That should be gotten rid of and it should be criminalized, but not the expression.
What if I just show it in my house privately? Doesn't that encourage the industry?
Well, that's what people would say. It encourages the industry.
No, you discourage the industry if you say you can't film children in sexual acts because it's exploitative of young people. That should be illegal.
But you've raised a good point. There is an exception in this particular law with, quote, serious religious, political, scientific, educational, journalistic, historical, or artistic value, which the government gets to determine. And that's one of the problems, that how you interpret obscenity,
if you were doing a movie,
artistic.
Of course, most movies say, you know, no animals have been harmed in this. But you could, if you were doing a movie, I guess they're saying that that might not count as prurient interest. Well, you can see why this is a thicket of difficult issues.
Yet another one.
Because I'm sure while some people might come out one way on showing animal videos, they might come out another way on showing child pornography videos.
Exactly. And also a lot of animal rights activists use such videos or the depiction of cruelty to animals as part of their campaigns to educate the general public about what is going on. Two weeks ago, the 15-nation Security Council at the United Nations approved, 14 in favor, an immediate ceasefire in Gaza and full withdrawal of Israeli forces. The United States abstained from the vote. Yet Israeli forces continue to use military force against Hamas and Palestinian women and children. There are other ways to stop Israel, says award-winning journalist and author Naomi Klein. In her recent Nation magazine article, Boycott, Divest, Sanction, Naomi lays out measures that could economically slow down Israel. When weaker measures have failed, such as protests, petitions, and lobbying, Naomi writes that the boycott, divest, sanction strategy is practical on a country so small and so trade-dependent. The strategy worked to help end apartheid in South Africa and may have a real possibility to weaken Israel. We're pleased to have with us today Naomi Klein. Naomi is the author of The Shock Doctrine, The Rise of Disaster Capitalism, and the earlier international bestseller, No Logo, Taking Aim at the Brand Bullies, and the collection Fences and Windows, Dispatches from the Front Lines of the Globalization Debate.
Naomi, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you. Great to be with you.
You know, a lot of people have been forwarding me, and of course I get The Nation, your really important article, Israel, Boycott, Divest, and Sanction. It really came, I think, as a breath of fresh air and a strong one in the midst of this assault on Gaza to people, particularly in the Jewish community, but even beyond that. So why don't you lay out for us what your thinking is, what BDS really means, and some of the objections to what you're saying. But lay out the plan.
Sure. The timing of this column, you know, in many ways it's been very strong. It's been really because people are feeling so helpless about what they're seeing in Gaza, and they want to do something besides sign another petition. So the strategy I'm calling for is the strategy that a huge coalition of Palestinian groups have been calling for since 2005, when there was a historic gathering of a wide variety of Palestinian groups, political parties, trade unions, all kinds of civil society groups. They drafted this call for boycott, divestment, and sanctions on the anti-apartheid struggle in the 80s against South African apartheid. So it makes that explicit analogy, and it calls for the types of methods that were so successful in the 80s, like schools like Columbia and Stanford, which had huge pension funds and endowments, calling for the divestment of those endowments from companies invested in South Africa, as well as consumer boycotts, as well as economic sanctions, which governments would impose and enforce. So it's a multi-pronged strategy, and it's very different from the strategy that we have right now with relation to Israel. We, meaning most Western democracies, where not only are we not sanctioning Israel, we are rewarding Israel for ongoing lawlessness, increasing our trade relations, deepening cultural ties. And just to give you a few examples very quickly, just in the past couple of years when Israel's lawlessness has really intensified, and I'm thinking about the period from the attack on Lebanon in 2006, the siege on Gaza, which has been called collective punishment. I'm not talking about the bombing that we're seeing right now, but the embargo slash siege. In this period, Israel was invited as the guest of honor for the Paris Book Fair, for the Turin Book Fair, celebrating the 60th anniversary of the State of Israel. So really getting special treatment. And then you have a series of new trade deals, one with Mercosur. Israel is the first non-Latin American country to sign a trade deal with the Latin American trade bloc, Mercosur. Israel's trade with Canada increased by 45% last year. So there's all kinds of these things going on, also with the European Union. So not only don't we have sanctions in the midst of this lawlessness, we have the opposite. And this used to be called, in the South African context, constructive engagement. And I think that what we see in the context of the brutality in Gaza right now is that constructive engagement has failed utterly. It's escalating Israel's lawlessness, and now it's time for a new strategy. And that's where BDS comes in.
Now, is any group actually, I mean, you mentioned all of the Palestinian groups, but has any group actually started any of this yet? Is there any boycott going on now that people can join?
Yeah, in the U.S., the U.S. Committee Against the Occupation is supporting the BDS call, the Boycott, Divestment, Sanctions call, and is focusing in on two companies. One is Motorola, and one is Caterpillar, because these two companies are not only invested in Israel, they are deeply embedded in the IDF, in the Israeli military, in terms of equipment sales. So I think they're really great boycott targets, and it has to start somewhere. In Canada, we've a few trade unions that are leading the way on the boycott call. I think the labor movement in Canada is quite a bit more progressive than in the United States on issues like this. Probably wouldn't be transferable, at least at this point in the U.S., but there have been resolutions passed at a few major trade unions in the same way that trade unions led the way.
Tell me for a minute about the academic boycott, because that was very controversial over the last year prior to the invasion of Gaza. I know that England, there were debates back and forth about it. Is there anything going on with that? Because that seems to me another area that should be really ripe for a boycott.
Yeah, this has mostly been focused in the UK, the academic boycott. There's a huge amount of misinformation about it because there is a very aggressive anti-boycott movement, very well-organized, very well-funded anti-boycott movement, very pro-Zionist movement that has been spreading disinformation about the campaign. So portraying the academic boycott as a Nazi-style boycott of Jews and using that analogy right off the top. I mean, if you go to these anti-boycott websites, the first thing you see are Third Reich pictures of, boycott Jewish shops, things like that, and trying to draw this connection. So it's been really ugly, and the truth is that the academic boycott was never a call to boycott Israeli academics, not to do research with them, not to invite them to your conferences. Absolutely not. It is a boycott of the institutional ties between, in this case, British universities. That was the idea that, a lot of British universities and certainly a huge number of American universities have institutional relationships with their Israeli counterparts. And it was that type of official relationship that they were kind of targeting. But the campaign against the academic boycott has been basically successful in Britain. So these resolutions that were passed at inside academic unions have been repealed because there was legal action. I mean, I personally think it was a mistake to lead, a strategic mistake. I know many people will disagree with me who are involved in the boycott campaign, but I don't think academics should be excluded from the boycott. I don't think writers should be excluded. I'm a writer, and I'm participating in the boycott, and I can talk a little bit more about that later. But I don't think it makes sense to lead with this issue just because it is so open to misinterpretation, and unless you already have an advanced discussion going on about why there is a need to boycott Israel, starting with academia immediately raises this issue of academic freedom. And even though it's a red herring, and even though there's been all of this distortion, I don't think it's been useful to put that issue up front. I think it's the kind of thing that you go to once there's already a strong consumer boycott and a strong divestment movement.
Yeah, I agree. Naomi, what kind of progress has been made in the United States? I remember the Presbyterian Church was discussing the issue. Has any institution with such heavy social weight as that come on board, or at least are we making any progress?
There was some progress and a resolution passed. I'm not sure the status right now, because once again, this anti-boycott movement did target the Presbyterian Church, and I'm not sure whether they, like the British unions, backed off. So I have to check that. Because the anti-boycott campaign has been more aggressive than the actual boycott campaign. I think that's going to change, and it's already changing in the context of the Gaza attack.
Have other groups been targeted by the anti-boycott movement?
Yeah, individual academics in the usual fashion. But more than that, there is, I mean, it's so complex, but I didn't know about this when I wrote the column, but since I wrote the column, somebody sent me a link to the Bureau of Industry and Security, U.S. Department of Commerce site, where there seems to be a measure to boycott companies that are boycotting Israel. That's how aggressive Israeli diplomats are being, as they're trying to get official sanction. I think it's very interesting in the context of your show. I'm not a lawyer. I think you probably all are lawyers.
Yes.
But Israel is taking a very legalistic approach to this, right? The way they won the battle in Britain was presenting the academic boycott as a discrimination issue, saying Israeli academics were being discriminated, and they threatened legal action, and the British teachers' unions, who had spearheaded the boycott, got legal counsel, and their lawyer said, okay, you are vulnerable on this, and if you don't want a huge, costly legal battle, you have to back off. So they backed off. So a lot of this has been fought in the legal arena, and now you have this threat that companies who do announce, you know, I talk in my column about a British telecom called Freedom Call that announced that they would be boycotting any British company. They wouldn't be doing business with any British company because they didn't want to lose customers. They announced that as the Israeli attack on Gaza began. Well, what this U.S. Department of Commerce measure would mean is that Freedom Call could then be subject to a U.S. boycott because it was participating in this boycott. So you see how aggressive they're being.
I realize the pitfalls with the academic. But let's, for example, with Caterpillar, because I want to ask about Motorola. Caterpillar, we all know, that's the American company that custom-built the bulldozers to destroy the homes in the occupied territories. That's the bulldozer that actually killed Rachel Corrie.
Right, and the center actually had a lawsuit against Caterpillar on behalf of the Corries that we lost. And there's been a pretty long campaign against Caterpillar in this country and around the world.
What about Motorola?
Well, first of all, I would steer people to the site for U.S. campaign and the Israeli occupation. This is a group that Phyllis Bennis is very involved in. I'm sure she's been on your show many times, and theoccupation.org. And then if you go to boycott and divestment, you can read about the Caterpillar campaign and get all kinds of resources on boycott and divestment, and you can read about their Motorola campaign, which is called Hang Up Motorola. And it talks about the relationship between Motorola and the IDF. They are manufacturing equipment used by the Israeli military. That's why they are being targeted. So that is a really good place to start a campaign in the United States, because you have that direct connection with the Israeli military. Now, of course, the broader boycott movement that Palestinian groups have called for is not just targeting companies that have a direct relationship with the military, like Caterpillar and Motorola. They are talking about broader consumer boycotts that would include Israeli wine, Israeli fruit, leisure tourism. But I think it does make sense to start with the clearest issue, and that's where Motorola and Caterpillar come in.
In the article, you talked about a number of objections that people have to your idea of a boycott. One of them is, which we hear all the time, is why single out Israel? What about the Congo? What about Uganda? What about Rwanda? What about wherever other major human rights violations are going on? How do you answer that?
Well, frankly, this is an argument that comes up a lot, and I find it very odd because there are sanctions imposed on many of those regimes already. There's certainly broad agreement that there should be if there aren't. So this idea that Israel is the only country in the world that has been subject to these calls, absolutely untrue. For years, the Free Burma movement in the United States, for instance, has had a campaign going modeled on the anti-apartheid movement, which is calling for divestment, sanctions, and consumer boycotts. So Israel is not being singled out. And as I said earlier, I think Israel is being singled out, but not for tougher treatment, but actually for lenient treatment.
I think that's a crucial point, Naomi. Right. I mean, I think the answer in some way, you just put your finger on it, is, one, why should Israel be exempt from the rest of the human rights movement and laws, et cetera? But even more so what you're saying, why should it actually get special privileges because of it?
Well, Israel takes the stance, and always has, that they're internally innocent and they're the victims. Even the propaganda that they're putting out now about how the war in Gaza started, that they've been under attack from all these missiles and they're only trying to protect their own citizens. And that's shown to be totally false. The attack on Gaza was pre-planned since last March. The Israelis actually provoked the latest rocket attacks by invading Gaza in November. But the propaganda fight is really being won by the Israelis. And that's what makes it so frustrating for those of us who want to try to show some solidarity with the Palestinians.
And, another point in terms of this propaganda war, what we've heard from the beginning with great consistency, which is why we know it's a talking point, from the start of the Israeli war on Gaza, for lack of a better phrase, it certainly isn't a war in the traditional sense, is that what they are doing is very similar to what the U.S. is doing in Iraq and Afghanistan, responding to terrorism with these measures. And once again, you get this claim that Israel is being singled out for unfair treatment, right? And this is where this is a fact that we also need to challenge, because, of course, we did criticize the U.S. military for its illegal war in Iraq. We criticized it very, very loudly. It's very difficult to boycott the United States, particularly if you're an American. But personally, when there was a boycott of U.S. products in the Arab world that was sparked by the invasion of Iraq, I personally thought that was absolutely fair, and I supported people's right to do that. It's very difficult to do if you're an American. But if other countries wanted to boycott the U.S. because of what it was doing in the U.S. and Afghanistan, more power to them. So there is a consistency in this position. We didn't support the siege on Fallujah, and we don't support the siege on Gaza. And there's real similarities in the methods used.
Naomi, there was a couple of other reasons you gave why people are opposing the boycott. One of them, of course, that we again hear frequently is that they alienate rather than persuade Israelis. And I guess a little adjunct to that is that it hurts innocent people and people will get poor. And I guess you could argue, compare it to the Cuban embargo and look what it's done to the economics of Cuba. And not every Cuban, in fact, most Cubans, aren't guilty of very much here, if anything. The argument you addressed is punitive measures will alienate rather than persuade Israelis.
Well, I mean, I think there are two points to make here. One of them I already made, which is that we have tried, there's the carrot and the stick, right? And we've been trying the carrot, and we've seen an escalating lawlessness from the state of Israel. And this idea that we would alienate Israelis, one of the things that really prompted me to write the column is that I'm hearing more and more from my friends and colleagues in Israel that they have had enough and really want are calling for sanctions to come from outside because they've lost any hope of this idea of internal pressure.
And that's a really important point. I think that's very strong, Naomi, what you're saying.
And we link to this really historic letter that was sent by more than 500 Israelis. It was sent a week ago to every foreign ambassador stationed in Israel. Read it. We link to it from my website, naomiklein.org. They sent the letter to all the foreign ambassadors, to the United Nations, to the European Union, calling for South African-style sanctions and to stop treating Israel with kid gloves. The letter is very, very clear. They don't feel they can do this from the inside. So we're starting to hear that. I believe we're going to hear it more and more from Israelis. I mean, obviously, the mainstream groups like Peace Now haven't come to this position, but some very respected Israeli academics and artists are putting their name forward and calling for this. But the other side of this, and this is where I just feel this idea that we would be, punishing Israelis and it's not fair, and I've received a lot of letters since the column came out from people criticizing me for being one-sided in my boycott calls, is just that it fails to notice this very important fact, which is that there is a one-sided boycott going on. It's been going on now for 18 months, and it is the brutal, illegal embargo on Gaza imposed by the state of Israel and supported by the U.S. government, supported by my government, the government of Canada, and many other Western countries. And this is depriving Palestinians of food, of life-saving medicine, of water, of cooking fuel. Just amazing to me that people would call this legal call for a boycott that would do things like deprive Tel Aviv of a few international symphonies and maybe some academic conferences as being one-sided. It's extraordinary.
Both Michael and I grew up in Jewish families, and both of us share your ideas with respect to Israel, and both of us would support boycott and sanction and divestment. And how did you come to that idea? People must ask you that.
I mean, this is the first interview I've given, and I haven't talked very much about it. It's always such a difficult calculation of when you want to leave yourself open to the onslaught of hate and propaganda that any position like this will inspire. And my office has certainly been bombarded since the piece ran, but we've also gotten a huge amount of supportive letters. But I just would say, you know, I've gotten a lot of supportive letters saying, you know, thank you for your courage. And the truth is, it wasn't courageous. It was really cowardly. I've thought about writing this column about 5 different times over the past couple of years and not done it. And I just did it this time because I just was so deeply outraged by what I was seeing in Gaza. In many ways, this is the easiest time to call for a boycott. But, you know, I didn't have the courage to do it until now. That said, I was participating in the boycott quietly in my own work, in the sense that I made a decision when Israel attacked Lebanon that I would not publish my book. My books have been published in Israel for 9 years now. My first book, No Logo, was a bestseller in Israel, and it was published by a commercial house called Babel, and then they published my second book as well, Fences and Windows. And I was writing The Shock Doctrine, my most recent book, when the attack on Lebanon happened, and I just decided there's no way I'm signing again. And so when they sent me a contract, I said, I'm sorry, but I'm going to respect the boycott call. And I got in touch with an Israeli publisher that is really very much a part of the anti-occupation movement, a part of the peace movement in Israel. But it's a very, very special publisher. It's called Andalus. And Andalus is exclusively devoted to translating Arabic writing into Hebrew. And it's one of the extraordinary things also that this, you know, all the outrage in Israel about cutting off publication of Israeli academics and so on, which was never in the cards, but there's almost a de facto boycott of Arabic writing in Israel. There's been extraordinarily few Arabic writers have been translated into Hebrew, even though there are hundreds of English books and French books and German books translated into Hebrew every year. Here Israel is in the heart of the Arab world, and there is this block of communication just because of lack of interest in writing by, you know, whether it's fiction or political science, published in Hebrew. So Andalus started in order to publish Arabic writers in Hebrew. So I donated my book to them. So I'm boycotting the Israeli economy. I'm not profiting from it in any way.
Amazing.
That is amazing.
Naomi Klein.
It's fabulous.
We love you here. Thank you for your courage. NaomiKlein.org or endtheoccupation.org. We will put those up on our website. And we thank you very much for being on Law and Disorder.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org.
It's a great honor for all of us to welcome Adam Shapiro to Law and Disorder. Adam is one of the co-founders of the International Solidarity Movement, which is attempting to support by resistance the incursions of the Israeli army against the occupied Palestinians on the West Bank and in the Gaza Strip. Adam's bravery and outspokenness on the question of solidarity with the Palestinians has earned him current death threats by the right-wing, fascist-like Jewish Defense Organization. Adam Shapiro, it's really an honor to have you on Law and Disorder. Welcome.
Thank you very much. I really appreciate the opportunity.
I think we've had you before, Adam. I mean, I go back all the way to when you were in Arafat's house in the occupied territories. What have you been doing since then? What is ISM? And then we'll go into the discussion of Gaza.
Well, since then, most notably, and the thing that changed my life most importantly, was that I was kicked out of the West Bank, expelled and forbidden from returning by the Israelis. It's been 6 years now that I've been unable to actually re-enter the Palestinian territories. In that time, I've done a few documentary films in Iraq and Darfur, most recently about Palestinian refugees all over the world. I've spent a lot of time in Palestinian communities in the diaspora, including in Lebanon last year, especially during the events around the Haberid, and then more recently and more importantly, working with Palestinian refugees from Iraq to find a safe haven. They're a targeted community specifically because they're Palestinian in Iraq. And I've been finding countries to help grant them asylum and safe haven, including in Chile and Brazil, and more recently Iceland and Sweden have come forward. So that's what I've been doing.
It's not even an aspect I've ever even thought about, but it's certainly important work, Adam. Are you still working with ISM?
No, I mean, I'm not officially working with ISM, mainly because I can't get back into the territories, and so much of the work and what needs to be done and needs to be decided is based on what's happening on the ground.
Tell us what ISM is briefly, and then we'll talk about
that. Yeah, well, you've got a close connection with ISM. We want to hear about that, too.
Certainly still have a close connection with ISM. The International Solidarity Movement, ISM, was formed at the beginning of this intifada. It was mainly an effort to help bring people from around the world to come join Palestinians in solidarity in opposing the occupation and directly opposing it in terms of using nonviolent resistance to very concretely and strategically oppose what Israel was doing in the West Bank and Gaza and Jerusalem, and has evolved into somewhat of a, as the active sort of resistance that in the West Bank especially has dwindled somewhat on the Palestinian side, what we've done more has become more of a group that does advocacy and eyewitness and reporting and things like that. Although still to this day, every week in Bilin Village, there are protests against the wall, and ISM is part of that. So that's what we've been doing.
Tell us about your companion, Huwaida, and what kind of activity she's been involved in.
Well, Huwaida has continued. She did take a short break of some sort to come back to the U.S. for law school, but otherwise has been in the Palestinian territories in Palestine continuously, continuing working with ISM and a few other things. She's been doing trainings and organizing with Palestinians. Some people, some of your listeners, may have seen a YouTube video that's making the rounds of her standing up to Israeli soldiers, I mean, physically standing in front of Israeli soldiers who are pointing their guns to shoot at Palestinian protesters.
I saw it the other day. It's one of the most moving videos I probably have almost ever seen.
She's putting her body between the children who these Israeli soldiers are shooting at with automatic rifles and telling them, stop, you're shooting at children.
Yeah.
And they would take aim and she would jump in front of them. Quite moving.
There was a high chance, in my view, that she could have been murdered right on the spot by
it's
Israelis.
It's certainly possible. I mean, after what they did to Rachel Corey and Tom Herndahl, and Brian Avery, I mean, it's certainly possible, but she's really quite brave, and in fact, right now, for the last few months, she's been involved, one of the key organizers of something called the Free Gaza Movement, which is independent from the ISM, although obviously a lot of people who've been involved with ISM are involved with Free Gaza. This has been the effort to bring boats to break the Israeli siege and blockade of Gaza, and they've successfully done that a few times.
She was on the first boat, is that right?
She's been on four of the five trips so far. The only one she happened to not be on was the one that got rammed by the Israeli Navy 2 weeks ago.
Right.
But she's on a boat right now. They left earlier this morning from Cyprus and are heading to Gaza and are planning to, again, break through and get to Gaza with doctors, with journalists, and with aid.
The propaganda coming out of the Israeli Defense Force and all the Israeli spokespeople in the media in the United States has been uniform. It's like a talking point that all we're doing is trying to defend the citizens in the southern towns of Israel from this hammering rocket fire that's coming from the terrorist Hamas in Gaza. What's wrong with that talking point?
Well, that talking point, chooses a moment in time to sort of pick off from, which is more or less right around the time of, December 18th, 17th, something like that. And basically totally ignores the last, whether it be a year and a half of history, in which this total imprisonment, complete imprisonment of the Palestinians in Gaza has been in effect through Israel's blockade of the Gaza Strip and sealing off of the Gaza Strip. It ignores the last 40 years of history of direct Israeli occupation in the Gaza Strip, which has led to the de-development of Gaza, which has led to the impoverishment of the Palestinians there, which has led to, some of the worst deterioration of living conditions anywhere on the earth. And it ignores the last 60 years of history in which, which is how most of the people who are currently in Gaza actually got there, which is that 80% of Gazans are indeed refugees from Palestine, made refugees in 1947, 1948. And Gaza is really actually not their home. Their homes are just across the border in some cases, within sight even of their refugee camps where they're living now. This version of history is to say that, the conflict started on the day that Israel decided to fire back or to fire at Gaza. Now, even this notion of defending themselves is a bit false in that on two fronts. One, it's become very clear, and in fact, even the Israeli government's own websites and statements prior to this latest, assault on the Palestinians, indicated that Israel knew that it was the country, it was the party that had violated the ceasefire that was in effect with Hamas back on November 4th when it attacked and killed six or seven Palestinians in Gaza. This has, even CNN actually has actually reported on this, so they did once and then don't seem to mention it ever again. BBC certainly has reported on this fact. The second aspect of why it's not really defense is that among the rocket fire that was occurring prior to the ceasefire and prior and even during the ceasefire, in which over the period of 4 months prior to November 4th, there was 1, 2, 1, and 4 rockets fired over those 4 months. During that whole time, the most of, over 99% of those rockets fell in open, empty areas. And now, since this assault began on Gaza, a number of Israelis have actually been killed by these rockets, and a number more have injured, and there's actually been far more property damage. And so it certainly leads one to conclude that to some extent, while Hamas can't control the exact precision location of where these rockets will be fired and where they will land, they can more or less generally know where they go. The previous rocket fire that was occurring, the over 99% that was hitting open, empty fields, had no intent of killing, maiming, injuring, or even destroying property, but it was really meant as a political message in response to what Israel was continuing to do in the West Bank and Gaza, which was occupy, which was detain and arrest, which was to kill and execute. Israel's argument that it's acting out of defense is a pure fabrication.
That's been refuted pretty heavily by academic people who are familiar with laws of war. Your point, I think, is a strong one, that there were very few rockets, they weren't doing very much harm. And then you get this overwhelming Israeli assault on Gaza. There's simply no way a doctrine of self-defense under the laws of war allows that kind of assault for the kind of quote, if you want to call it that, a political statement or provocation that Hamas was making.
Certainly not. And then if you want to go also to the question of proportionality, or even before you get to the question of proportionality, first principle among in international law, of course, is to try to avoid war, which is, through exhausting all efforts of diplomacy and negotiation. And of course, we know that Israel was not only provoking Hamas continuously to have an end to this ceasefire, and we know that Israel's also been planning this operation now they've admitted to planning it for 6 months, and we know that they built a mock urban setting in Israel for training specific for fighting in Gaza. We also know that Israel did everything it could to prepare its people for going to war in advance of this. I mean, this, in a sense, actually, the lessons that they learned from the Lebanese war, which was that when you want to go prosecute a war, which Israel did in Lebanon as well, you need to take certain steps to make sure that you can have the support at home. And Israel has been doing that over the months and months. They've conveniently allowed the governing, the parties and the elected officials who are the defense and prime ministers and the foreign minister have conveniently allowed people like the national security minister, who's from a right-wing party, to be the person to be, you know, calling out for rocket to end the rocket fire of Gaza. But nonetheless, this right-wing, you know, minister, Lieberman, who's in charge of national security, is nonetheless part and parcel of the ruling, you know, establishment of Israel. And they work hand in hand. This is part of the cabinet. And so the messaging that was coming out, if we look at the month or two prior to this assault on Gaza in the Israeli media and in the public statements by these officials, was very much gearing up towards war. And there can be no mistake that this was pre-planned and organized.
Adam Shapiro, if the stated reasons are false, if it's propaganda and lies, what do you think the real reason is for the attack on Gaza?
My own take on this, and this, you know, is certainly open to debate, but looking longer term, Israel has always acted from the position of using its military force to achieve political goals. Sometimes it has overstepped itself in doing so, and certainly the war in 2006 can be seen as a failure of that sort of approach. Certainly in 1956, with war on the Suez, can be seen as an overstep to some extent. But specifically with the Palestinians, when Israel has used force vis-a-vis the Palestinians, Israel is looking at actually a history of success in this regard, in the sense of when it used overwhelming force and all kinds of various tactics of assassination and manipulation and imprisonment and all of that towards the PLO, it was eventually able to move the PLO from a position of seeking full national liberation towards accepting a two-state solution to ultimately becoming the Palestinian Authority and essentially the implementer of Israeli security in the West Bank and for a while even in Gaza. I think Israel's taking the same approach basically with Hamas, which is that if you use overwhelming force against this political movement, you can eventually bend it towards your will. And we've actually seen some effect of that already, in the sense that prior to his assassination, Sheikh Yassin, the former head of Hamas, was already at that point talking about a long-term truce with Israel and an acceptance of the two-state solution. And we've seen Hamas move and join, actually, the Palestinian Authority by running for elections and taking over, winning those elections, becoming part of the government, the very establishment that it was opposed to in 1993 and throughout its history up until 2006. And we've seen even more recently Hamas being willing to accept a two-state solution and the 1967 borders. So Israel has been able to effectively use military force to move its political opponents to positions that it wants. Now, the question, of course, then still remains, does Israel actually want a two-state solution,
yes,
or not? And I
exactly.
think that's a valid question to debate. But where they want their opponents to be, Israel has been successful in using military force. And I think this operation can be seen in that context.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree with you. My own feeling is that there should be one state, and that the state should be citizens who live there
sure.
should be citizens of an entire state. I think that the setting up of an exclusive religious state back in 1948 was a mistake. Looking back, it certainly seems to be, if you consider what's happened to the Druze as a consequence. What's your feeling on that?
I mean, I do think, you know, that from a principle of equality and from a principle of human rights and justice and all of that, that certainly a state for all of its citizens, of the people who live there and the people who are from there, so that the refugees actually can return to their homes and to their homeland, I do think is the only real step, the way moving forward. But, you know, I mean, what we're seeing, of course, always is the opposite. And in fact, you know, it's funny, even as it claims to be, you know, in justifying what it's doing as the work of a democracy and all of that, in the media, it's propagating that myth. At the very same time, on the ground, it's taking steps to erase that myth, as happened this week when Israel banned the participation of Arab parties from running in the next parliamentary elections, which are coming up next month. Parties that currently hold 7 seats in the Israeli Knesset are now banned from running in the next election cycle. And this really puts to question, I think, once and for all, I don't see how anybody can deny it at this point anymore, that Israel is really not a democracy and that it is a democracy only for a certain type of citizen that it has. Unfortunately, the media really, you know, the mainstream media does not report in this way. And actually what we saw earlier this week in the New York Times, there was an article which cited something like 80 to 90% of Israeli citizens are in favor of the operation in Gaza, which is just flat out ridiculous because, after all, over 20% of Israeli citizens are Arab. and are not in favor of this war. So is the New York Times then deciding that actually a democracy in Israel is only for Jews and only their polling actually matters? That seems to be the implication.
That's a really, really strong point. I'd like to ask you, what kind of actions would you advocate to people listening to you on this show, and where can they go for taking those actions?
Well, certainly to keep up with reports, you could certainly go to the ISM website, which is palsolidarity.org, palsolidarity.org. We have up-to-the-minute reports from our activists who are currently in Gaza and are eyewitnesses to what's happening, as well as people who are still in the West Bank. We also, I think it's important for your listeners and for anybody who is concerned to not forget about the West Bank at this time. Even as this assault is going on in Gaza, there are steps being taken in the West Bank to expropriate more land, to build more settlements. There's violence. I mean, a settler killed a Palestinian child after he bound him and shot him at point-blank range.
Oh, my gosh.
There's great violence going on there as well, and that needs to be, you know, not forgotten about. Free Gaza movement is sending the boat today. Call your politicians. Call your, any point that the show is heard, to call your elected officials that these efforts to bring in doctors and journalists are upholding international law, you know, and then also just giving aid, because quite frankly, there's a great, great need for relief aid in Gaza, emergency aid now, longer term reconstruction later, and not to ignore that there will be a very strong politicization of aid connected to any aid efforts coming out of the U.S. government for sure. But more broadly speaking, there will be an effort to use relief aid in the aftermath of this to achieve certain political results that favor, you know, U.S. policy and one of the Palestinian groups affiliated with Mahmoud Abbas at the expense of the Palestinian people.
Sure. I'd like you to tell our listeners how they can get a hold of the films you've made. And then secondly, I'd like to ask you, and I've asked other guests as well, Jewish Americans who've come to the position that you've come to and Michael and I have come to. How was it that you came from where you started out to the position of this Palestine solidarity work and the critique that you have of Israel? What path did you go along to, and what was the evolution of your thinking?
Well, in terms of the films, let me just answer that real quick. My prior films on Iraq and Darfur are available on Amazon.com. You could just look up my name and you'll get them. My latest film, called Chronicles of a Refugee, is a six-part documentary series. It's self-distributed, and it's available at PalestineOnlineStore.com. And you just look up Chronicles of a Refugee. In terms of my own path, I wasn't raised in a Zionist home, or an Israel really never factored into our consciousness growing up, with, I would say, the only exception being 1982 during the invasion of Lebanon, just because in general in New York, where I grew up, there was a lot of reports about New Yorkers going and volunteering, Jewish New Yorkers going and volunteering for the Israeli army, and that sort of made waves in the community. But for me, really, it was about both at university and then afterwards learning about the history of the conflict and being able to study it from, I would say, a more objective perspective than what most Jewish Americans are raised with in this country. My parents are both educators and have always prided themselves on trying to present, you know, objective points of view and perspectives and exposing my brother and I to all different sides of things. And then finally, just simply going and living there. I challenge anybody to go, you know, no matter what your perspective is, to go live for 1 week in the West Bank. You don't have to go live in Gaza. I mean, go live 1 week in the West Bank in a Palestinian village. And if you leave thinking the same things you thought before you left, then I think there's something wrong with you. There's just simply no way to experience this life that Palestinians lead and the conditions under which they live them and not emerge thinking that this is wrong. It's just flat out wrong.
Well, Adam, really, we want to thank you for, over the years, your incredible courage, solidarity, and work. And it's been really an honor, as it always is, to have you on our show. Thanks,
Adam.
Thank you, Adam Shapiro.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org. That's lawanddisorder.org.